Today on Wings.
There is something specific happening between men and women that we call violence against women. And it's a political phenomenon, the way right-wing death squads are a political phenomenon. Violence against women affects not one woman at a time, but all the women through each woman.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Frieda Worden. I'm visiting with Lee Lakeman, the author of the book Canada's Promises to Keep, The Charter and Violence Against Women, and its other title is the CASAC Report. CASAC stands for Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers. What prompted the writing of this report?
We had an opportunity to get federal funding from a particularly supportive justice minister, Alan Rock, but part of the requirements were that we would design a research project and we would report at the end of that research project. Once we knew we were going to have to account in writing anyway, we decided, why bother writing something if we don't get to write what we want? So we put considerably more effort into it than was required by the grant in order to have some of the history of the anti-violence work in Canada documented. It tells a little bit of the history of 1973, the first rape crisis center and transition house formation in Canada, but mostly focusing on the work that was done by anti-rape centers and transition houses in Canada about 1995 to 2003, which is, I would say, one of the Canadian women's contributions to the international struggle on violence against women. You know, it's what we did with the luxury of the money that was available to North Americans in the 1970s. There was a boom, and we took as much advantage of that as we could. Women like me just opened shelters and rape crisis centers and fought for support. It certainly wasn't a government plan. It was our plan. In the industrialized West, England, Australia, New Zealand, the United States and Canada, there was a very quick development of transition houses and rape crisis centers, almost like spontaneous combustion, which I think Gillian Riddington coined as a phrase to describe it. Development in each of those countries, but a little bit different in each country. And Canada was kind of uniquely placed because we had a bit of the social welfare state, like England, but we also had the impulse for the ERA kind of equal rights amendment in the state legislation, and in our case it became the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It was a kind of approach to using constitutional law separate from the economic agenda, whereas in England there was an economic agenda for women and the transition houses were on top of that. So there's two different strategies in play, and there are writers named Dobash and Dobash who write about that, but clearly the Canadian story needed to be told, so that's part of what we did in the report.
So the Charter of Rights and Freedoms is quite new in Canada, is it not?
It is new. It's only a couple decades now that we're really thinking in that way. You know, we've yet to evaluate how much we've accomplished with it, but we've seriously tried to use the courts to pressure the government to face up to women's inequality and do something about equality.
And that's very much the crux of this report.
Well, we tried to, because we were accounting to the justice system, that part of the report is pretty developed, but we tried to keep three streams going. One was, what could we do through the courts, and what have we succeeded and not succeeded in doing? Another was, what do we do just by the development of women's groups from rape crisis centers through to national and international women's groups, and we locate ourselves in the World March of Women about that. And the third strategy was, what reforms are possible within the neoliberal state, within the neoliberal economy. So we kept all three strategies going through the report.
Wow. Now, you mentioned that in England, the women's movement strategy was mostly an economic strategy. Do you feel that women have gotten diverted in a way by the justice strategy? Maybe I'm asking you to draw conclusions too soon in the interview, but...
I actually started the report with the attitude that we needed to explain the uniquely Canadian situation, which was that we had a bit of a welfare state which was being dismantled by neoliberalism, and we had an equality initiative through the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and that put us in a position to move one against the other, which is, you know, of course, the best feminist strategy, not either or, but both. And so we were working that all the way through this 5 years. And of course, what's terribly important is to realize that in Canada, this is the 5 years where structural adjustment comes to Canada. And so we have a terrible attack on all these strategies. It's very hard to use any of them at the moment.
Now, by structural adjustment, just as by way of a footnote for those who haven't been following WINGS for the past 18 years, we mean the move of resources from the public sector to the private sector, and also the move of jobs out of the public sector, and the lowering of the salary base, is that, and the increase of profits. Am I getting that right?
Absolutely. And particularly what I was trying to describe was the economic pressures on the Canadian government to rearrange itself so that it was more supportive of business interests than it was supportive of its citizens' interests. So, for instance, we had technically still have a right to welfare, to a basic social assistance level across the country. That was more like England than it was like the United States. However, although technically it's still on the books, in fact, the government's been reorganized in its federalism in such a way that it's very difficult to be sure that if you went to a provincial government, you would be given the economic right, that you'd be given the actual check. And that's changed everything. I mean, the Canadian transition houses and rape crisis centers utterly counted on the federal-provincial relations that used to be true. And so that shift in the governance of Canada and the internal structures of Canada have a very profound effect on the delivery of services about violence against women and the development of women's groups that could fight violence against women.
Talking with Lee Lakeman, the author of the Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers report, Canada's Promises to Keep, the Charter and Violence Against Women. One of the outstanding features of this report, and in some ways the most interesting feature, is that it covers a number of high-profile violence against women cases from the perspective of the sexual assault centers who had contact with them.
It's a very big range of cases. We were particularly looking for how the high-profile cases were used to create the impression in Canada of a different truth about violence against women than we were actually seeing. So, for instance, there's a serial killer that has had much attention, the Bernardo case. And what we were particularly interested in was that many, many women had told on this man before he became a serial killer. They had told on his behavior as a lover in their lives, that he, for instance, promoted strangulation as a sexual practice. And eventually, women who left him realized the danger and were fearful and told on him. He also stalked women in his neighborhood before the term stalking was popularized. And the women told on him. Those women got no response from the police. And in fact, very few people even know that they did go to the criminal justice system and they did report this man before he was a killer. And consequently, we consider that the system is partly complicit in the creation of this monster, and that we can point to several other high-profile cases where that's also true, where the criminal justice system colludes with the individual man, perhaps unwittingly, but nevertheless effectively, to turn him into a monster that is now unredeemable and impossible for us as a society to control, other than by putting him in jail for life. So we wanted to point that out. Also, there was a situation, for instance, of 911 operator in Winnipeg, dealing with Aboriginal women calling from a ghettoized part of the town. They called five times, two sisters in the same apartment, and in fact were killed while on the phone with the operator, because their call for help simply wasn't heard as a believable dangerous situation. They were seen to be drunk, perhaps exaggerating, not willing to do what other people said they should do. And, you know, these women died as a consequence. We think that's far too common an occurrence, that there should be some obligation on the part of the government to respond immediately when women call for help, and to not judge them in that moment, but arrive and reduce the danger. Also, in Quebec, there was an entertainment entrepreneur, head of the comedy festival, or a significant player in the comedy festival, Roseon, his name is. And he was convicted of abusive behavior with young women. I think one woman in the end succeeds in getting a conviction. But even when the conviction was won, the judge decides afterwards that it would be unfair to him for him to have a criminal record, because he's an entrepreneur and because crossing the border would interfere with his profit making. And so they simply change or exaggerate the version of the young girl so that this becomes a minor event, even though she's won a criminal conviction and even though he's clearly guilty of what he's been charged with. And he gets an unconditional discharge. He doesn't even have a record. So we were examining these high-profile cases to say, A, we are a witness. We know what's going on. And B, we want to tell our part of the story, which is never legitimized by the criminal justice system. We know what happened here.
Now, how is it that the sexual assault centers in Canada have a different view of what's going on than what is in the newspapers?
Well, A, we're not profit-making. B, we're based on the women's struggle for equality. We don't do this as a Salvation Army kind of service. We don't do this as a government-delivered service. We work with women who've been raped and abused as part of gathering up women's strength to fight for women's equality. And, you know, equality being an understatement, which is also examined all the way through the report. What we're trying to do is establish women's autonomy and rights and access to freedom.
What are some of your successes?
Well, we're all still living in the belly of the beast, so our successes are qualified. But, for instance, Jane Doe was already a feminist living in Toronto in the uprising of the 70s, and a man climbed in her balcony window and attacked her. She called police, and in the course of the police investigation, she realized that he'd been operating in that neighborhood for some time and that police knew it. And she was angry that the women in her neighborhood had not been warned that there was a man repeatedly climbing in balconies and that they knew some things about him. And she was angry that she saw herself as having been set up as bait. So she gathered up a gang of other women and started what became a 10-year fight. First, to win the legal right to sue police, which she accomplished, and then a second case to hold the particular police department of her city responsible for what they did. And she succeeded in both those cases. And there's been a long line of women who are trying to hold police accountable to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and to accountability. Of course, you know, police forces, like other groups of armed men, don't give up power easily. And so it's not that this struggle is won by a long stretch. But I would say the struggle to hold police accountable is very lively across the country.
So in your book, you document the places in which women's equality considerations disappear. And one is with the prosecutors.
Mm-hmm. Our report partly documents who's bossing who about what. Many people don't realize that within the Canadian system, prosecutors are meant to be somewhat independent from the government of the day, but also take political direction in their policy. And And every country that I'm aware of has an uprising going on about violence against women, an uprising of women. And consequently, every political force all over the world is trying to capture that and use it for its own interests. So when we expect a politician at a provincial level to intervene in a particular case, we're in fact inviting him to over-politicize cases of violence against women. And so we can be contributing to a right-wing agenda by doing that. On the other hand, the Attorney General of any province can send a directive, and they do send directives, saying, don't bother prosecuting if you can't win these cases. Now, we already know that the record of winning on violence against women is very, very low. But also at the micro level, in each case, we think of this as an adversarial process in which we are up against the rapist and trying to prove something in the courts. But in fact, the prosecutor's job is not to fight for us. The prosecutor's job is to implement the government's policy and to in some way fight for what the law is in that area. And so the first thing we have to do is win the prosecutor over. And it's not always an easy thing to do, particularly if his political bosses are telling him, don't spend a lot of money on violence against women, don't take on high profile cases, don't take on cases you can't win, don't give it too much time and attention. I'm not somebody who thought the courts were a great route for freedom, but the fact is that Canadian women are taking men to court. They've gone after Bishop O'Connor, for instance, who raped and abused Aboriginal women who were in residential schools over which he had control. They've gone after fathers long after they got away from them. Powerful men, rich men. And they've gone after professionals in a big way in the last 10 or 12 years. So I see this as a phenomenon that women are demanding the backing of the Canadian state in holding those men to account. Women are not naive. They know very well that the chance of winning those cases is not good. And it's not good. However, if you manage to get past the prosecutor and you get that case into court, you have done something. They have managed to put that man under scrutiny and bring him before the public for consideration. And that's a very, very powerful thing to do. And I do think we have an obligation to support those women who are trying to bring those men before the courts, even if they can't win the case.
So there's a couple of things in here that I want to unpack a bit. One of them is this thing about there not being any money. No money for legal aid, no money to prosecute. I mean, this is increasingly happening as a result of what you're talking about as the neoliberal project, right?
That's exactly right. We see that part of what is going on is the privatization of public law. So there is now no available public money, for all intents and purposes, for poverty law or for violence law. A poor woman who is trying to use the state to protect herself against violence against women gets the worst of all possible worlds. She probably doesn't have a women's group that has money. She probably doesn't have access to a legal aid lawyer. She doesn't have money of her own. And so there is no one to protect her interests in that struggle.
Again, this is Frieda Worden talking with Lee Lakeman. Lee Lakeman is the author of the CASAC report. Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers is CASAC, and the report is titled Canada's Promises to Keep the Charter and Violence Against Women. It's an extremely interesting book, more than 200 pages long, based on a major research project. But what we're talking about now is CASAC's strong suit, which is the frontline workers, most of whom are volunteers, and what you all are doing in this system.
I guess that's probably the thing I'm proudest of most, and the main reason for writing the report was to remind women what we've accomplished here in Canada and to try and reinforce ourselves to hang on to it when no one else values it. It's true that we now have rape crisis centers across the country. There's probably nearly 100, more than 50 of them belong to our association. And that's across both English Canada and French. And each one has from none to 10 paid women and probably twice as many volunteer women. And each of those women answer crisis calls or respond to women who come to their centers trying to fight violence against women. And in each case, we're inventing strategies where centers get behind her self-defense and her recovery. And in the course of that, trying to build up a massive force of women to change the world, really. And so every caller we try to involve in our center on a long-term basis, every caller we try to activate in her own community. And in the report and in our centers, it's very clear that the best therapy for women is activism toward our own liberation. You know, we've even found the research to back that up therapeutically in the report. But we know that. I mean, that's what our lives are built on, that support groups are really mutual aid groups, are really political action groups. Support groups are really consciousness raising, which are really forerunners to action groups. And that continues to be our most powerful achievement in the anti-rape movement.
What kinds of women call you?
Well, women who are married to powerful men who have no other place to hide. Women who have never been married, can't get access to welfare, and are living on the street. Women who are trying to escape men who prostitute them. Women who are trying to escape their fathers. Women who have small children. Women who didn't think to leave until they were 60. Women who are abused by men around them because they're choosing to be sexually active with women rather than with men. Women who, you know, at the moment we're dealing with a complicated case of a woman who's escaped Nigeria and managed to get into Canada and wants to use the gender clause in our immigration policy to protect herself. The Chinese women who were dumped off our coast, being trafficked into Canada, potentially to New York, as sex slaves. We've housed all those women and worked with those kinds of women on the phone. And that's true across the country. Pretty much women of every race. Disproportionately, we work with poor women and women of color, particularly Aboriginal women, who suffer some of the worst ravages of violence against women, of course, because all men feel free to attack them. Of course, you know, if you work in this field, you know that the majority of violence against women comes in the forms of attacks by husbands, lovers, fathers, and surrogates of those positions. So residential school runners, teachers, doctors. And so we don't see anything unusual about the women trapped in prostitution or the women battered in marriages or the women attacked by their fathers. What we can see is that that's a far too normal condition for women.
And I suppose in a way the courts and the prosecutors and the police and the judge all think of it as a normal condition for women too. Maybe that's part of why it's so hard to get any action from them.
Well, I think they don't think that. I think the courts and the police and the criminal justice system rarely face how normal violence against women really is. And when they're forced to face it, when we demand response, the system turns on us and says, well, there's something wrong with you as a victim. You're not an acceptable kind of victim, or you always were a victim. Somehow or another, there's something wrong with you. And if you succeed in getting past that barrier, then the next challenge is, well, we caught that guy and he's the bad guy of all time, the monster. And so when they're forced to actually confront an individual man, which they can't escape convicting, then they paint him into a totally abnormal character. And it's not our experience at all. Our experience is that the majority of violence against women is done by pretty ordinary men in pretty ordinary circumstances. And that any solutions we find have to change the relationship between ordinary men and ordinary women and change that power relationship.
In conclusion, I'd like to ask you once more to return to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and to say, despite how it may or may not have been actualized so far, what's in that that you look to that can be of help in the struggle against violence against women?
Well, if I start from an international level, which I can now do as a result of this work, it's clear that the CEDAW agreement at the UN level can be read to be in relation to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. That is, that you can read one as informing the other. So our domestic policy, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, has now been interpreted by our courts to entitle us to not just formal equality, that is, treating both men and women the same, but our courts have interpreted that we're entitled to substantive equality, that is, our governments must have policies which address women's inequality, and so you do something different with women if you need to, in order not to make inequality worse. Now, there are debates going on in our country about whether or not that compels the government to do positive things or whether it only restricts the government from not doing worse things. We say it has positive, the government has positive obligations. And we now know from the exploration of the charter and the cases that we've been involved in, charter cases that we've been involved in as CASAC, that we can argue that. We now expect, for instance, that there is some obligation on the police to put extra resources in to be available to women for the 18 months after the end of a marriage, since we now know that the risk in the 18 months between when she decides to leave and starts making moves and when she's clearly established as independent of him, away from him, that's the danger period. That's the murder danger period. And nowhere in the country is it true that the police put extra money, time, and resources into that protection. So we would say that's a charter issue. Similarly, we're now arguing that women use welfare, that is, social welfare payments, to escape harassing bosses, incestuous fathers, and abusive husbands. And therefore, access to welfare is a critical charter issue for women's autonomy, for women's freedom. That's also one of the arguments we're putting forward, that they cannot legitimately dismantle the right to welfare since there is an obligation to substantive equality. And there are other similar arguments that become possible in this new context of the charter.
Thank you very much, Lee Lakeman. Lee Lakeman is the author of Canada's Promises to Keep, the Charter and Violence Against Women, which was just issued. It is the report of the Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers. Tell me, what's the contact information, Lee?
You can go to www.casac.ca.
For more about WINGS, visit wingsradio.org or email wings@wings.org. And you can find our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.